The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of the show, you're free to do so. Just send us an email if you end up using any content. If you care to, you can send us letters at our new address, which is The Final Straw Radio, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina, 28816. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.
This week, we're excited to share the voices of Jess and Olive, who both did legal support and do prisoner solidarity with the folks facing federal prison time from the struggle at Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Jess did legal work supporting the struggle in Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline in 2016 and into 2017, and continues to support political prisoners in the case. Olive came in as a paralegal in September 2016, survivor of water crises in West Virginia, and as a sun dancer. Olive stayed through the raid at Ochedi Camp near the end of February 2017. Support sites for the federal prisoners from Standing Rock can be found at the Water Protector Legal Collective website, mostly up to date, waterprotectorlegal.org, or the following sites: freerattlernodapple.com, that's DAPL, standwithredfawn.org, freelittlefeather.com, also at the following Fedbook pages: Justice for Angry Bird, Justice for Dion, the number 4, Free Little Feather, Free Red Fawn, and Free Rattler. A quick announcement. The day after this airs is New Year's Eve, and cities around the U.S. and abroad will be continuing the, I believe it's a Greek anarchist thing, tradition of noise demonstrations outside of jails and prisons. Check out It's Going Down for a list of places holding these where you can join in and be heard behind bars. In Asheville, folks will be meeting up on College Street in front of the courthouse and jail at 7 p.m. and will bring noisemakers, warm clothes, banners, and signs. Also this week, Blue Ridge ABC will be showing Instead of Trouble, because the media is on a quick break from that. We'll be showing the latest Frontline PBS documentary entitled Documenting Hate, America's New Nazis, about the Adam Waffen Division at 6:30 p.m. on Friday, January 4th at Firestorm Books. Also on Sunday, January 6th at Firestorm, BRABC will be hosting its monthly letter writing event from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Firestorm. No experience necessary. Finally, the Final Straw Radio is proud to be alongside its Going Down, Crime Think, and Mutual Aid Disaster Relief in calling for a week of action around the weekend of January 20, 2019, with the charges from 2017's anti-inauguration protest dropped, we can focus on other forms of long-term solidarity and mutual aid, creating a fertile soil for the future resistance and creativity. You can find the challenge and ways to plug in at cwc.im/survival.
So I'm here to talk about the folks that picked up heavy charges and are still inside in relation to the water defense during the resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline, or DAPL, around Standing Rock, North Dakota. Can y'all introduce yourselves for the audience and say what relation you have to the issue?
Mm-hmm. I'll go first. My name's Jess. I showed up to camp in November of 2016. Primarily, my role was working in legal. There's many different legals at camp, but ended with the Water Protector Legal Collective as the criminal defense coordinator. My primary role was to match water protectors with volunteer attorneys who came in to represent them for all of the nearly 850 criminal state cases, in addition to doing political prisoner support.
Hi, my name is Olive. I arrived at Standing Rock in September of 2016, and I didn't leave until the raid of Ochetti, February 22nd and 23rd, except for the 2 weeks that Rattler had first gotten picked up on his federal charges, which is how I got involved working as a paralegal, in particular for his case. And unfortunately, from living in camp, you know, for as long as we had, I had multiple loved ones, including Angry Bird and Lexi Littlefeather and his wife, Leola Cowboy, and their daughter, Jaden, who I was also close with in camp, that I knew that helping, you know, one person with federal charges would protect and help everybody, all of the Akichita that had gotten federal charges. So I got involved legally with that. But when I was in camp, I had three of my own arrests related to going out on the front lines. Yeah, and had to deal with my own legal cases as well, mm-hmm. that I got acquittals. And then one of them, the affidavit got lost, so I didn't have to go to trial for that. Yeah, I guess, I don't know. I mean, going to Standing Rock was for multiple purposes, but having to go through like my own water crises living in West Virginia, being Appalachian, having to deal with like chemical and extractive industry and energy transfer partners doing things on the East Coast as well, that was really damaging to the environment, and being a sun dancer. So that was my reasons for going initially.
Olive also had this to add about their participation at Standing Rock. Quote, "If it's relevant, I didn't mention another responsibility I had while being in camp. I formed with two other femme people, two spirit and women's security branches, so genderqueer folks like myself and women/femme people could deal with our own safety/decolonizing issues within camp. This is how I began to work with Akichita security directly. The role of Akichita, the several council members that made up camp for collective decision-making, and the ceremonies we participated in were all ways we were actively decolonizing our daily lives and defying state intervention in disputes among our community. Concepts of transformative justice try to exert the same concept of, quote, don't call the cops, be accountable, unquote, but don't necessarily have the structures to do it like traditional indigenous societies have, unquote. Another addition to the audio that I'd like to include is a short write-up that you can find in our show notes about the concept among some Lakota and Standing Rock Sioux of the prophecy of the Black Snake, which has been applied to the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Did you use the term Yakichi?
Akichita.
Akichita. What does that mean?
So Akichita is a traditional society amongst Lakota people. A lot of people say that it means warrior, but that's a really watered down concept for the responsibilities and roles that people as Akichita take on for their people. That in a general sense, it does mean that you hold people accountable to their actions, and there's different societies within the Akichita. Like Rattler, as an example, is like he's part of White Horse Society. And they all have different responsibilities to uphold, to keep people safe. And their role in camp, you know, was to stand between water protectors and police as a way to de-escalate tense situations. Yeah, and just to be able to, I guess, make sure that our own people, you know, acted with integrity and didn't do reactionary things as well. So there was a lot of like 24/7, you know, patrols of camp and stuff. I mean, each individual camp had their own security branches too, a lot of them, because there were a lot of, I mean, it's hundreds of nations of indigenous people in one place. So they have their own traditions and societies and stuff to keep track of their own people. But Akichita were some of the main enforcers of just making sure drugs and alcohol wouldn't come into camp, that there wasn't violence, people weren't selling and doing drugs, taking care of assaults, just making sure if there were a few times that we were able to find people that had infiltrated camp and to remove them. It was just to like keep the peace, you know.
As an aside, I wanted to read a little more information from Olive about Akichita. Please forgive my pronunciation, because these words I'm reading are from a written statement. Quote, Traditionally, Akichita would go to battle as a last resort and were always last to leave, but they acted as protectors and to hold people accountable and dispense consequences when necessary. One example being on buffalo hunts, people were not allowed to take more than they needed or to hunt by themselves because it hurt not only the other tribal members, but the buffalo population. Akichita made sure the hunts happened with integrity. They also kept Natchez, elders, and the people informed. They were mediators of conflict. They were recognized for acts of bravery and selflessness. Unquote.
In the very recent is when this, when the struggle at Standing Rock was in the media, and when thousands of people joined folks that were defending the land that they lived with at Standing Rock. But could you sort of break down, just briefly reintroduce folks to what the struggle was and sort of a brief overview of how it went?
Okay. That's kind of hard to do briefly. Energy Transfer Partners was laying down an illegal pipeline that the Standing Rock Sioux tribe had not consented to be laid underneath the Missouri River. And it was originally planned to be laid in the Bismarck community, but Bismarck did not want the pipeline to be laid down because they didn't want to take on the risk to their drinking water. So it got moved closer to the reservation. It was being laid down adjacent to a I believe it was a natural gas pipeline that's already laid underneath the river. There were multiple grave sites, ancestral sites, and sacred sites that were desecrated during the construction of the pipeline, and multiple treaty violations for several nations of indigenous people were also violated during the construction of the pipeline. So it was nonviolent direct action to physically stop the construction of DAPL, of Dakota Access Pipeline.
Can you talk about what sorts of charges and arrests came from the No DAPL struggle?
Well, I mean, I can speak from personal experience, like with my charges and with several other people that I had gotten arrested with. We definitely became guinea pigs in the sense of they hadn't really dealt with such a large mobilized resistance to stopping, to not as like nonviolent direct action to stop construction of a pipeline, that we became guinea pigs in the sense of they didn't really know what to charge us with. And the arrests were blatantly illegal. It was definitely like an arrest now, charge later kind of mentality of we don't really know what we're going to charge them with now, but we'll figure it out later. Mm-hmm. So I would, like when I got arrested on 10/10 on Indigenous People's Day, I was in a teepee with 15 other people, one of them being a grandmother, and we were having Chinupa ceremony. We were saying prayers with her sacred pipe, and cops came and were dragging people out of the teepee. And I can't even remember most of the charges that they gave. I know that they said that they were going to get me for criminal trespass, mm-hmm. but then they gave like two other charges mm-hmm. that I didn't even get charged with. And in the end, I did get criminal trespass and engaging in a riot. And then those charges got dropped. Mm-hmm. And then they immediately, the same day that my charges got dropped, it was probably over a year after mm-hmm. Indigenous People's Day in 2016 that I was supposed to go to trial for that. Then they dropped those charges and they issued a warrant on the same day with a new set of charges, which mm-hmm. was impeding a government function because mm-hmm. they knew that they couldn't get me on criminal trespass and engaging in a riot. So there was a lot of people getting charges and then charges later getting dropped. Or like with my 1022 arrest, I definitely was arrested. It was one of the most brutal arrests that I had to go through out of the three that I went through, but they just ended up losing my affidavit. I didn't even have to go to court because it was just mm-hmm. so incompetent and they can't keep track of anything. I mean, they're arresting hundreds and hundreds of people some of these days. 1022 is one of the big mass arrests that we had. It was the first large mass arrest. But I think the main purpose, like with charges, and especially in regards to the federal charges, when they gave committing a felony through fire and civil disorder is a charge that is specifically politically motivated. They've only given it to people, like they've given it to the Black Panthers, Vietnam War protesters, Black Liberation Movement, AIM, American Indian Movement, and now they've given it to the Standing Rock federal defendants. And they only use it to make an example out of somebody to for political imprisonment, to be perfectly blunt about it. And committing fire through felony is also a very, very rare charge that most, you know, the federal attorneys told us, it was like most attorneys don't even know that this charge is on the books. It's not something that they really give to people. And from me researching it, I've only found a couple of other charges that are politically motivated for them to be giving, like committing felony through fire. But the main point was that they said that October 27th, when North Camp got raided, that putting up the barricades to keep the cops from illegally raiding our camp on 134 and Highway 1806, that it was impeding commerce. So that was how they were able to give federal charges in their minds, even though it was the cops that were actually impeding Highway 1806 for several months on end, impeding commerce after North Camp got raided, because the only things that were put up there was like wood was set on fire, tires. There wasn't any kind of like permanent blockade. It was definitely like a first responder kind of to slow down the cops so that they can't get into camp to hurt people. Yeah, it's just the militant response. I mean, it was very blatantly obvious, you know, being at Standing Rock, what it really means to live in a police state and having that continuum of colonization for Indigenous people, that it's just modernized itself, that none of it's ever stopped.
Yeah, I think Olive summed it up. I would say like a lot of what they had said, I would say like the large majority of charges that people experienced were criminal trespass, physical obstruction of a government function. Those were the two primary charges, engaging in a riot. And then what I would also say is that, yeah, what like Olive had said, the two largest mass arrest dates were from October 22nd, which Olive was arrested on. And then October 27th is when they raided North Camp or Secret Gown Camp. And that's when the seven federal charges came out of, as well as around 120, 130 state charges. Whereas like originally of those 130 charges, almost everyone was charged with felony explosion or intention to do harm by fire, which were later dropped by a judge in North Dakota, and then people were recharged with federal charges. I would say that, yeah, I think what Olive said is totally right. Like, especially in the beginning, they had no idea how to charge people or to charge people with what they clearly had never really dealt with a lot of cases like this before. A lot of the case law that we were like relying on when we were dealing with all these cases were there's no case law for a lot of these charges, or did they just ever experienced it, with the exception of like actually some like union resistance like in the 1920s and 30s, but there wasn't too much of that. What I would say in terms of with the federal charges, definitely disproportionately affected Native American folks, whereas like everybody that was charged federally identifies with a tribe or a nation, or, you know, identifies as indigenous. But also, even though October 22nd and 27th were the largest mass arrest dates, I always like to point out 1115, which was November 15th, which is also known as Red Dress Day, which was done in solidarity and in memorial of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And that day, 27 people were charged with felonies, many of which were Native Americans, including the cops had stopped a car and shot out all the windows with five people inside the car at point blank range. I always want to point that out, because a lot of people don't know that had happened amongst a lot of like terror that had been rained on a lot of different people. That day was especially violent and traumatizing for many folks.
Yeah, it was really terrifying.
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah. Has there been any sort of, impunity is a pretty normal circumstance, I think, with law enforcement, especially in when dealing with communities of color and Indigenous folks and such. But has there been any sort of like accountability being called for the officers endangering people's immediate safety by firing point blank into vehicles or anything like that?
What happened that day, which is like disappointing in some ways, but exciting, you know, it's good in other ways, was, like I said, 27 people from that day were charged with felonies. And after the first set of trials where they had two convictions and one acquittal, one of those convictions was later overturned and Rebecca Jesse won her appeal at the Supreme Court, which is pretty exciting. But following that outcome, the prosecution offered everyone from that day what's called a pretrial diversion, which is like sometimes known like an ACD in other places, where it's you don't enter a statement of guilt. And so long as you don't get arrested or break the law in a certain period of time, the charge is dismissed. So they were offering them pro non-tunct, which meant that they were backdated to the day of November 15th, 2016, such that when people signed that paperwork, the case was immediately dismissed. So it was a really good deal for people to take, and almost everyone did. But by signing a pretrial diversion, they have language in there that made it such that you weren't able to file for civil litigation or things to that effect. Granted, no one's really tested it, but it seems kind of slim in terms of an opportunity, or no one's taken it up yet.
So. Yeah, and it's interesting to try and look at like what the potential legal responses could be when it comes to DAPL, also because there were mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
Mercenaries involved with security, and even with, you know, mercenaries that most of them being ex-veterans or law enforcement themselves, they're not under the same kind of walls as law enforcement or even the military, because they're, you know, they're like a private corporation. So it was interesting to, you know, when they're making these comparisons, telling law enforcement, comparing us to jihadists, because they say that we have a really strong religious component and conviction to what we're doing, you know, protecting the land and protecting people, and blatantly making the comparison, framing us as eco-terrorists when we were just trying to stop, you know, the pipeline from getting laid down in the first place. You know, there are other countries, you know, countries like in Africa, you know, where they'll blow up pipelines because they're so desperate to get the ecocide to stop. And because corporations just wreak havoc on their land, that they'll literally cause like their own forms of devastation to make that point of like, you guys aren't going to be laying this stuff down anymore. But yeah, and I think it's also important to recognize, like, for when it comes to the federal charges anyway, it's definitely a really big threat. You know, when you have like United States of America versus Michael Marcus, Michael Drone, Redfawn Fallis, James White, Dion Ortiz, you know, that's like as direct as you can get when we were talking about like political imprisonment and federal charges, and that they're giving these charges to people for specific reasons. One of the main reasons being, though, is that they are members of sovereign nations as indigenous people, because they're enrolled, you know, like Redfawn and Rattler are enrolled at Pine Ridge. Redfawn's mother was a very well-known member of AIM. You know, Angry Bird James White is the only enrolled member of Standing Rock that got federal charges. And he was one of the people that was there the longest. Dion Ortiz, you know, his family lives in Pueblo. They're from New Mexico. They're enrolled. But anyway, I think that's also really important to recognize that, you know, it was sovereign nations of people that were protecting, you know, their treaty rights coming out there. And I know for Angry Bird and Rattler, them being veterans and having the kind of like training and background that they had, that as veterans, the skill sets that they had was not to support state interests, which would be protecting the pipeline, but that they were actually there to protect their ancestral lands and protect their people, was also a very big threat to the federal government. I mean, so it made them pretty big targets, you know.
Can we talk a little bit more about the details of the people that you mentioned? Like you told a little bit right there about Angry Bird and about Rattler and their backgrounds, but could you introduce the audience to them, as well as Redfawn, Dion Ortiz, and Little Feather?
Okay. I'm not sure when Little Feather got to camp, but Little Feather had been there. I knew him from North Camp before North Camp got raided. So I met him in October. So he had been in camp for quite a while. He's Chumash and Lakota. So his mother is enrolled Chumash from California. Let's see. And he was locked, one of the federal defendants other than Redfawn that was locked up the longest. He got picked up in November, they said, for a warrant. If I remember correctly, yeah, it was for a warrant. That was something unrelated to camp. And then eventually he got picked up again, though. And then that was when they gave him federal charges when he was in jail.
It was like in March of 2017 when he was taken into custody and not released.
Right, because when he got picked up in November, we were all happy when he came back to camp in the winter.
You're like, oh, this is awful.
It was a blizzard. It was so funny. It was a blizzard. And he's like pulling cars out of snowbanks and stuff, like he'd never left. He was just happy to be back. Yeah. And Redfawn Fallis is also, she lived in Colorado, but her family is also from Pine Ridge. And she has been doing, I guess you could say, activism work, but, you know, she's been involved in this kind of stuff for quite a while. You know, they would consider her to be an AIM baby because of her mom. Yeah. And then Dion. I just started talking to Dion, unfortunately, because of the federal charges, but he came to camp pretty early on as well and stayed there the whole time.
Yeah.
He's a pretty young man, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he's the youngest with federal that got federal charges.
Yeah.
He's only in his 20s.
Yeah, when the federal charges came out, Dion was still only 19, whereas like most of the other folks are a little bit older. He had just left living in New Mexico and was living with his uncle in Colorado. And when him and his uncle wanted to drop off donations up at camp, they went up in, I believe, September of 2016, and he just decided to stay.
Also, Olive had these notes to share about the federal defendants who have been sentenced. Quote, Little Feather's mother is part of the Morongo band of Mission Indians in California. So I forgot to mention that he is also Morongo, in addition, also Lakota and Chumash. Rattler is a descendant of the war chief Red Cloud, who also signed the Fort Laramie Treaty in 1868, one of the treaties that we were defending with our occupation through camp. Rattler's Lakota name is Matutanka, or Big Bear. Angry Bird's Lakota name is Sunka Wakan Sicha, Bad Horse. Not everyone with federal charges are Akichita or Ikche Wichasa. Rattler, Little Feather, and Angry Bird are Akichita and Ikche Wakasa camp security. Red Fawn and Dion had other responsibilities and ties to camp.
And participated that way.
So all of those people that we've been talking about are people that caught federal charges.
Yep. All of them were charged with civil disorder. But the thing that's interesting about a civil disorder charge is that you can't just get charged with civil disorder. There has to be a predicating cause, right? There has to be something that goes along with it. So it was like this weird thing where it's like you could only, like, if they would have been convicted, they couldn't be convicted on one, only on civil disorder. They had to either be convicted on the intention to do harm by fire, which had a 10-year minimum, and then it could go up to 15 with the civil disorder addition. And I believe that, I think Red Fawn's minimum that she was looking at was 25, and then it was 25 to life.
Right.
So it's like an enhancement, basically?
Right, exactly.
Was that charge that they were getting, that was getting put on them, was that for the barricade that was on the highway?
Okay. It was on, well, Rattler and Angry Bird and Dion got their charges for the barricade that was on County Road 134. Right. Little Feather got his charges for the barricade that was put up on Highway 1806, adjacent to where North Camp was, where 1851 Treaty Camp was actually put up, where we were camped at.
Right.
The Water Protector Legal Collective website only lists two folks who served North Dakota state charges. That's Alexander Simon and Mary Redway.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they both finished the charges, which is great that they're out. Can you talk about the discrepancy in charging between, like, why did some people get federal charge? Is that just, mm-hmm. it's not because of the law enforcement that they were interacting with, or mm-hmm. necessarily because they were in a separate, there was the idea, the argument of impeding commerce, mm-hmm. and that kind of makes sense. But was the discrepancy just based on that, or was it based on issues of eminent domain or what level of law enforcement they were engaging with?
I mean, with federal charges, like I said, definitely impeding, saying that they were impeding commerce. We realize now that that was the reason why they set up, one of the reasons why the cops ended up setting up barricades on 1806 for as long as they did, because they said fires had damage the structural integrity of the bridges and the roads. Wow. So be from
I was just laughing.
Yeah, yeah, I know, exactly. So they said the structural integrity of the bridges and the roads had been messed up from barricades of burning wood on top of cement and tires. Anyway, so they decided that they were good. They said at first, like, nobody can come across 1806 until the integrity of the highway is mm-hmm. yet established, and we can fix all the damage from you guys setting things on fire. And then they just never took the barricades down for months and months and months after that.
Right.
And they tried to blame it on water protectors, saying that it's like, well, now you guys are impeding commerce.
Right.
When really it was the other way around. It's interesting that the specific people that they chose to give federal charges, why they chose those people specifically for federal charges, and some of the stuff we're not ready to talk about yet, but some of the things that we can talk about anyway, like I said, them being sovereign nations of people, the people with military backgrounds, the certain responsibilities that they had taken on within camp made them more noticeable than other people because they took on roles as Akichita and Ikche Wishasha, which is also another traditional role amongst the Lakota of meaning the common man. It was another security branch within camp. And definitely the feds like to exploit if they see that there are certain relationships between individuals that they will try to exploit that. Mm-hmm. There was definitely a lot of the like let's pick off the people that all have relationships and connections to one another and try to exploit that, even if the feds are incorrect about whatever their assumptions are about how this person is connected to this other person. Right. That's still the motivation that they use, and definitely going after people that already have a record. If you already have gone, if you've done time before, statistically, it's a lot easier for the prosecution to lock people up if they already have a record. So they definitely went after most people who have gotten federal charges. They already have charges. Red Fawn's a really good example of that. To be frank about it, it was state-sanctioned rape that she had an informant that lied about who he was. Within 3 weeks of knowing her, establishing a relationship, planted a gun on her, and she ends up getting arrested during North Camp raid. And they tried to get her for attempted murder, which was just so bonkers that they weren't going to be able to get away with that. So, like, the next step down would be like, well, we're going to get her to develop a firearm, which has a significant amount of time because she has already got a record. So. Yeah, and I think like they also, for some people, I don't think with Red Fawn this was the case, but I do know that with some of the people that got federal charges, I can definitely speak on behalf, you know, for like Rattler and with Angry Bird, that these were people that did not, and I guess Dion too probably, but these were not people that had really like extensive, an extensive political background of any kind, right? Like they're radical in the sense of that they're indigenous people that defy genocide because they physically still exist and that they acknowledge their indigenous ancestry and they live traditionally, you know, that they engage in ceremony, they have connections to the reservations, etc. So in a sense that makes them political by nature, but it doesn't necessarily give them, you know, like that mentality, I guess, like this context that was framed around like what we're doing right now. Oh, it's so radical. You know, like they were coming from the space of, you know, this is long overdue. This water like affects my home. And, you know, we're here to stop a pipeline because these are my ancestral lands and people are getting hurt. And, you know, they were there. I specifically like to de-escalate to make sure that people, you know, they were there as first responders. And I think that the feds probably, because they were so genuine and that they were able to, that they had such large skill sets that they could offer people, you know, to make the movement. There were a lot of mistakes and a lot of organized chaos within camp, but there were a lot of successes as well. And it was because of the fact that we had so many people from so many different backgrounds coming together and offering whatever they had. And that was one of the most inspiring things about camp is that you could find people, you know, with all kinds of differing backgrounds. They've got, you know, a hard life and, you know, finding like a true purpose being within camp. So this rhetoric that they have of, you know, these people were leaders within camp also is like this really like colonial mindset to have of that there has to be an individual that calls the shots, because if they don't acknowledge the fact that camp one was set up with so many traditional societies and nations of indigenous people and allies, but it was indigenous people are setting up the structures and doing the organizing and stuff, that, you know, when we were functioning within camp, it was traditional. You know, we had councils. We would believe in like, you know, standing in a circle so that it's like, you know, equal as opposed to like doing this hierarchical thing. where everybody's like, we're doing things based off of consensus and we're having ceremony ahead of time. If one group has a meeting, we have to go to the next group to inform them about what we decided at this meeting, then get their consensus about stuff. You know what I mean? We have women's councils. We had the headsmen. We had to go talk to the Akichito. We had to go talk to the grandmothers. You know, like we couldn't just like go out and do stuff willy-nilly or have one person calling the shots for everybody. And for them to just blatantly make, you know, this the seven people that got federal charges into like poster children for the movement was because it's a threat for them to acknowledge that, you know, you can have just common people like the common man coming together and being able to organically with consensus be able to organize together and do it successfully. So it was definitely like giving people federal charges. We have to make an example out of these individuals.
Yeah.
It was, I definitely know that when it came to not just federal charges, but with state charges, a big, big reason for giving charges out too was that they were there to rewrite the history of what was going on within camp through court. Like everything, you know, colonial court system is all about what looks good and bad on paper and that's it. So if they can rewrite in court, this is what we think was, you know, this is what we're going to say actually went down in camp and how people were conducting themselves and why we're giving these people charges. It's like, that's literally like, that is colonization, is to rewrite history and make it into something that it wasn't.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I would say that, like, I think with what your question was in terms of maybe like why people were charged federally instead of with state charges, I think what Olive had said in terms of like what they were justifying along with commerce, like makes sense. But I think of like this one Leonard Peltier interview where he just says like, because in the American system, somebody has to pay.
Right.
And it's like, and especially like sitting through, like Olive and I both have sat through almost, I think, every federal hearing together. And like what I've garnered from a lot of it is that for the people, and like I hope that people, if anyone is listening to this and like was at camp, they like know and like can like internalize that there were so many people that were up on those front lines when the barricades went up. And every one of those people, I think, are just as vulnerable to getting charged federally as the six people that were charged with those charges. Both in Dion and Rattler's hearings, they had said that like they're not getting charged with starting the fire. None of the federal defendants are getting started with starting the fire. They participated in some kind of way, but ultimately, like they're, you know, the feds just didn't want to do their jobs that hard either. Like they just wanted to pinpoint people that they had found through all their surveillance, through helicopters, through Facebook, through other means, to just pinpoint enough people to tack it onto those folks and make it even better that they're all Native American. But ultimately, many of those people were just charged because they were standing there, they're near, they could be identified near the fire. But there, and I think one of the defense attorneys had said this to me before, I think that the feds had hoped and believed that. And I think what Olive says is right, that they targeted these seven folks, or these six folks, at least with the fire and the strategy to like flip their way to the top and try to get people to turn on each other and try to push on relationship dynamics that may have not appeared strong because they didn't have much affiliation with each other before arriving at camp. But ultimately that didn't work out.
Right. It was hard that I think it was with the civil disorder charge for the federal charges, like the aiding and abetting became like a really big focal point for like defense stuff, because it's not about if you started it or if you were coerced into doing it or any of that. It's just the point of like, if we think that your actions, we can frame it enough, like within a context to make it look like aiding and abetting, that's enough to get the civil disorder charge to stick.
If you're listening to this as a podcast and wish that we were on the airwaves of a station near you, drop us a line via our social media or at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net, and we can help you think through how to make this happen. Our show is FCC Radio Ready at 59 square free minutes a week for download for free at archive.org. And you can find out more at our website by clicking the broadcasting tab. Next, here's an update from Resistance in Canada.
So y'all have brought up outside organizations, like shadowy agencies that have been hired by the government to come in and do dirty deeds, surveillance and active targeting of individuals based on personality and relationships. The specific instance with Red Fawn being approached and engaged and basically state raped by I believe I read a paid informant for the FBI.
Yes.
Who did put that that gun on Red Fawn, and which was the basis for the charge for which she went away. And also with Red Fawn's mother's history with AIM, this smacks very greatly of counterintelligence program that the FBI was running for decades under that name that undermined labor organizing, indigenous organizing, Black Panther organizing, and left organizing in general around the country. I would imagine, because you said that there's some things that you're not prepared to talk about at this point, that it probably echoes some of that content. But I'm wondering what sort of that you can talk about has clued you into that sort of activity focus and attempt at disruption and undermining.
You mean with informants specifically?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think in camp we had a, I was part of for a while anyway, helping with people with like nonviolent direct action trainings, or we would try to get people prepared. I did a couple of meetings to help with like jail solidarity, and we would talk about, you know, trying to talk to people about like security culture and what that means to be enforcing, you know, to make that like a tangible, habitual, everyday understanding, as opposed to some like people just treating it as like protocol and feeling like they have like a rule book or they have to remember all these specific things. And I think like you just have to, I know that we would talk about it a lot at the nonviolent direct action trainings. That it's like, you know, we know that we're going to have informants and infiltrators, people that will try to cause problems. And as long as we're like adhering to security culture tenets, it's not going to be as much of a problem, and that we'll be able to mitigate at least some kind of damage control, that we won't have to feel like paralyzed by paranoia, but that we're going to be able to like maneuver through it. Cause we have to be realistic of the fact that, you know, they're going to get information. People are going to get intel on, you know, we were getting intel on them, they're getting intel on us. It's just the way that it works. But, you know, that's why it's like disinformation campaigns or can be so damaging, as well as just having to recognize that, you know, they are going to get intel, that you have to be very particular about what you do and don't talk about publicly, or just doing, you know, plausible deniability. Like, you don't just like tell everything to everybody, you know, just don't say more than what's necessary, because that helps to keep your loved ones safe too. It's not like a matter of distrust. It's about, you know, safety. But I knew going into camp, I found it to be really, especially towards the end of it, just because like when the drill pad had gotten put up and, you know, we had like razor wire and, you know, concrete barriers and all these trenches and stuff that were dug out, the same kind of methods that we had been using for nonviolent direct action to stop construction, it wasn't as easily accessible to get to the construction site anymore because the drill pad had been put up. And I know that at that point we had just all been there for so long and gone through so much trauma of stuff. Unfortunately, there were actions that weren't really like strategic anymore, and a lot of it was more like reactionary kind of stuff. And yeah, this whole like martyrdom complex that people had of like, I'm, you know, going to go out in a blaze of glory. Like a lot of people would say like, I'm willing to die for this. I'm willing to die for this, you know? And eventually at one point I got kind of frustrated and I was like, but guys, how many of you are like willing to do time? Cause like we live in a police state, like, you know, political imprisonment has literally been a thing since, you know, the reservations were first being set up as prison camps. Like Sitting Bull did the exact same thing that Leonard Peltier did with his people, that he went up into Canada, right? And that he was like trying to keep his people safe and, you know, was going into hiding because he was like resisting the reservations and stuff. I mean, it's all like a continuum of this. And, you know, so when Red Fawn got arrested and we all knew that it was Bull, like I remember the cops on October 27th said, you know, shots were fired and it was from your people. And I remember yelling at them, it was like, if it was from our side, it was one of your people coming over to our side. Because we were, you know, we were very honest with them that we knew that it's ironic that they talked about us being paid protesters. And I think that they do that not just out of like irony and ignorance, but also just like it's as this backwards way of like projecting, because that's actually what they do. They had paid protesters that were coming over and trying to intentionally stuff up for the water protectors. Right. So yeah. And I mean, they also just did it blatantly as intimidation tactics too. Like there were times within camp where we would blatantly see people that were like obviously not supposed to be there and very, very sketchy. And it wasn't just because they were like bad at what they were doing. It was because they wanted us to know that they were there and that they could get into camp, or that they could go out on the front lines and be out there with us. And that they could just like the arrogance that they felt that they could like get away with that kind of stuff, you know?
So was the question was about COINTELPRO and how it affected camp?
Yeah, basically. I was wondering about just sort of the, yeah, which I think Olive spoke to, like, recognize, how do you recognize that this is happening when it's happening, and just to sort of like point out this is not, because if someone in the listening audience wasn't familiar with the counterintelligence program or something like that, because this is a podcast, but it's also a radio show,
right?
That it could sound really paranoid, but when you can actually like point out and say like, look, like, we can tell by the way this person's interacting, despite multiple conversations, we can tell by the way this person carries themselves, or because we've seen them interacting with law enforcement in a friendly manner, or what have you. That's really important to point out, you know?
Cool. Yeah.
Did you have anything that you wanted to add to?
No, I mean, as someone who like went through a lot of the discovery, at least especially on the state level, something I always found that was really like not shocking, but like sobering, was even in the really early discovery for like arrest dates that were out of September, you know, way before the mass arrest started going down, but when things started popping off, when you would go through the discovery, most of it was total garbage. There was nothing in it, nothing that you can really convict anybody on. But what they would have is screenshots of people's Facebooks, and they would have pictures, and they would be following certain popular people who weren't even arrested that day, who, as far as I can tell, weren't even associated with the group of people that were arrested that day. But it was clear that they were tracking people across the country as they were coming back to Standing Rock and keeping tabs on those kinds of things. And then, you know, the material that you saw like later on with the leaks that came out through The Intercept, you see that they're, you know, mapping the different camps and trying to get an understanding of like who was in charge of what, or who was telling who to do what. And a lot of them were like comical and ridiculous, thinking that like Dallas Cold Tooth was like the head of, or like was a part of Red Warrior Camp, was like really hysterical. So it was like, at least sometimes with how like off that they were. But I mean, and Olive was like definitely probably more than most people I know, like, was there and experienced how much of a temperature drop there was, no pun intended, like after the first federal charges came out and the first person that was federally charged was Rattler and was taken into custody, is like the degree of paranoia and distrust that then like came out of that moment was really stark. Like people, especially trying to get people to even deal with their state charges, they'd just go AWOL. They wouldn't call you back. They didn't want to go in. They didn't want to deal with their cases because they were worried that was going to happen to them. Because, you know, Rattler was picked up on a bullshit state warrant that was not real, and it was confirmed to us that wasn't real. They said it was a clerical error after they had him in custody, and we paid the $10,000 cash bond for his state charges, and then he was taken by a federal marshal and put into federal custody and sat in jail for 4 months. Like it was all very much planned out, and people saw that, and the degree of distrust that then came out of that made it really difficult in the last couple of months for people to deal with their, whether it's their legal challenges or other things of that effect. Like people were just even more distrustful.
Yeah, and that's a big purpose in, you know, in them sending informants or, you know, infiltrators in the first place, is because they're banking on the paranoia. Mm-hmm. And I know, you know, when I would do like try to get prepared for like people to do like jail solidarity, you know, I'd be like, guys, it's one thing to be willing to get arrested, but it's another thing to be willing to spend time in jail. This is not like you're going to spend time in jail for a couple of hours. You're going to get a free meal or free bed for the night. Like this is, you know, you're putting yourself in a dangerous situation, being willing to spend time in jail. We don't really know how long people are going to get stuck in there, especially when they started doing mass arrests with people. I mean, we were literally, they sent people to a lot of county jails within North Dakota, but every time I got arrested, I got sent to Morton County every time. And it was really terrible. Like 1022, there were so many people stuck within our cell block that there was barely any space to even like lay down on the floor. And the jail conditions were, I mean, there were blatant human rights violations going on, hardcore. But one of the things that we talk about pertaining to security culture and informants and stuff specifically, you know, we would say things like, if somebody gets arrested and they get released like immediately, or they just never even go to jail, but they're doing the same kind of like conduct that everybody else is doing. Don't jump to conclusions, but that's definitely a major red flag of like, what's going on, right? Mm. When you go to jail, don't talk, don't be like dropping people's names or saying what camp you're staying at or what kind of work that you're doing, because everything that you say and do is being recorded at all times. Mm-hmm. You know, if the attorneys, when Water Protector Legal Collective was stable and you had people there that actually like knew what was going on, when they would call, they should tell you over the phone, mm-hmm. don't tell me what happened. Don't tell me what you got arrested for. Just tell me if you're okay. Tell me if you're going to stay overnight or if you need to get bonded out immediately. And if somebody tries to talk to you, don't talk to them. And that includes people that are also in the cell block with you that you don't know, regardless of if they're from camp or not from camp, mm-hmm. you know, because like jailhouse snitches are a real thing. And the feds bank on that they try to like cozy up to people. And we were definitely worried about that for our family with federal charges that were staying in jail for like longer durations of time. And I even had to worry about that with Rattler, you know, when we were stuck on house arrest, having to live here for long durations because, you know, we just have random people walking up to you and like trying to ask questions about stuff. And it's like, you can't, you know, in the environment that we're in with the stuff that we're dealing with, especially being in Bismarck, like you can't do that. Like, it's just, they really do bank on, you know, the feds are very predatorial. Like they definitely try to take advantage of people's good nature. If they think that like you're willing to be friendly or talk about stuff, or you're really feeling really isolated or traumatized, like they'll definitely try to have somebody swoop in and be like, you know, all that unexpected blessing or that friend that you didn't expect that you were going to have, or you're going to get like the jailhouse lawyer that's actually just trying to get a hold of your discovery to help the feds with stuff and like all kinds of sketchy things, you know? So I think it's just the reality of people have to, instead of being immobilized, we have to be able to not only adapt, but feel mobilized, that, you know, that we are also a force to be reckoned with, and that we can, you know, handle their kind of strategizing that they do, you know?
So Red Fawn is serving 57 months, and these, I'm going to list off the names and sentences, and I know that they started at different times. So like,
yeah,
in July, Red Fawn was sentenced to 57 months and is currently at FMC Carswell in Fort Worth, Texas. Dion Ortiz accepted a non-cooperating plea in July, and on October 22nd was sentenced to 16 months mm-hmm. and is at FCI Sandstone in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Michael Little Feather Giron is at USP Hazleton, serving 36 months. There's a pretty cool picture online of Little Feather and some other folks behind bars alongside of Tom Manning from the United Freedom Front. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Michael Rattler Marcus is 36 months, has 36 months as of September, is at also SCI Sandstone. And James Angerbird White is at, do y'all know where
yes,
Angerbird is at?
Uncle Angerbird got time served and they put him straight on probation, which was really great. We were suspecting that they were going to put him on house arrest for a while, but due to, unfortunately, health concerns that he has, so it's bittersweet. We're very thankful mm-hmm. that he doesn't have to do, you know, time, because house arrest, you know, was hard enough. But he was able to just go straight to probation, mainly because of health issues that he has. So he got 3 years of probation that hopefully won't have to last 3 years. It depends on the probation officer. It doesn't depend on the judge, which is really frustrating. You discover that with federal court, that judges can make all kinds of recommendations for, this is the kind of prison that they should get sent to, or maybe they should go to a prison camp instead of having to go to a federal, you know, in, you know, federal institution, or, you know, I don't think you should have to do probation for 3 years. If you only do it for 1 year, that's the minimum. And that's fine with me. Like that's all up to BOP. Bureau of Prisons is its own. It runs its own stuff, and the judge can only do so much. So pretty much the judge gets to decide like what happens during trial, which plea deal is accepted. And that's about it.
Is there any way that this stuff that's going through Congress at the moment about federal prisoners, nonviolent federal prisoners, could affect the charges that these folks are facing?
Rattler sent me a letter and told me that he may have gotten 3 weeks taken off of his sentence, but I find the new bill, I mean, it's obviously like very, very lacking, and I don't mean to do this whole like pessimistic, like looking at things for what they aren't. So that's why we're going to be dissatisfied with it. But looking at it for what it is, it's also really f***ed up. Like they're saying that people with nonviolent drug offenses, like the whole crack and the crack versus cocaine
discrepancies. Right. Yeah.
And that now the judge has more free rein to decide like, oh, I'm not like required to just like give somebody a life sentence. I can like be more reasonable and maybe not like ruin people's lives as adversely. But that doesn't do anything to change the people that already have life sentences. Like people are still going to rot in prison and it's still going to be overflowing with prisoners. And on top of the fact it only like affects federal prisons, and it does like, and most of the prisons that we have within the United States are state prisons. So
yeah, it's like 10% of the incarcerated population of the U.S.
Right.
Maybe is federal, let alone like not specifically the people that are going to be affected positively by this change.
Right. Yeah.
Well, so for folks that are out there that want to offer support for these specific people that we've named off, what's a good approach towards finding their contact and you know, figuring out what they need?
Well, I know that Red Fawn and Rattler and Little Feather have websites that people can go to, that you can find their mailing address, so you can send letters. People can never send too many letters. I know that Rattler and Dion, that's one of the things that they talk to me about frequently, is that they wish that more people would write, not that they aren't getting letters, but that they just like, they wish that more people would write or write letters, in part because it takes like, it can take 5 to 7 days for the letters to even reach them. So, so they have their own websites, and Angry Bird and Dion and Rattler and Little Feather and Red Fawn all have Facebook pages as well, that they could get info on how to support. They all have official support. I'm part of like the official part of the official support committees for the federal defendants, and we organize that. I mean, the Standing Rock movement, unfortunately, has had since the beginning, since before, way before anybody even got federal charges, like when camp was still up, a lot of opportunists, exploitative people that had their own ulterior motives and agendas that were coming in and trying to exploit the movement. And especially with federal charges, though, there have been people that have done fundraising that they say that they're representing federal defendants, or that they want to do fundraising to get money and resources to the defendants, and then it like never reaches us. Or even just with Facebook, there's just a lot of disinformation and rumors and all kinds of paranoia, even amongst Facebook, that people aren't entirely sure like who to trust and who not to trust. So people also just trying to like associate their names with people that have gotten federal charges, just because they're trying to gain like their own, I guess, like cred for themselves. Just really disgusting stuff. And so we all decided together as a family, and with, you know, with our legal teams, with the attorneys and stuff, that, and with the defendants specifically, that they, you know, that we wanted to set up the defendants to run their own support committees, and that they were choosing the people that were part of their support committees because they didn't want to have to deal with, you know, the exploitation. I mean, it still even happens with Leonard Peltier. Like he'll have people that says that they're doing fundraising and donation stuff for him, and it never reaches them. His family still to this day has to deal with that kind of stuff. So, you know, we're just trying to mitigate as much damage control as possible, and like let the defendants make decisions for themselves about them telling us what kind of support do you need, how can we be helping you, and how to get their stories out about what's happened, and, you know, just letting them take the reins. You know what I mean?
So is there a good place for people to go to find which are the actual real support or Facebook pages? I mean, I know the Water Protector Legal Collective website has links to.
Yes, that's one of the, I think that is probably the best site to go to get most of the links, if not all of them. But even if it just links to the Facebook page or something, you can just go through the info on the Facebook page and then get links to their official websites and stuff too.
So the other end of what people were calling the Black Snake or the Dakota Access Pipeline ends up in, in Louisiana in the swamps. The 3-year mark from the beginning of the protests is coming up, of the No DAPL protests, and the end of that pipeline is still being struggled against by a smaller crew with plenty of heart in so-called Louisiana. The struggle against the Bayou Bridge Pipeline, as it's called down there, and the action camp that's called Lois Levy, or Water's Life, brings together indigenous folks and settlers in struggle against energy transfer partners and in the southeast of Turtle Island. Can you all talk about, this is just one example of kind of what I see as like the heritage of the struggle at Standing Rock and the struggle against extraction and the struggle against these kind of pipelines. But can you talk a little bit about what sort of heritage you see coming from the struggle at Standing Rock?
I think, I know when I went to camp anyway, you know, one of the really important things was recognizing that, like, this isn't, you know, this isn't an isolated worst case scenario incident, right? Like, we're dealing with a pandemic when we're talking about ecocide and how, you know, industrialization and colonization all ties into that being a thing. And I think with Standing Rock, it made such a big impact because it's the largest modern gathering of hundreds of nations of indigenous people in one location ever. But it also had to make people recognize that it didn't feel as isolating anymore to talk to people about. It definitely was like that for me, like living in West Virginia and having to go through my own water crises with like Freedom Industry, having to deal with like family history of people getting sick from Union Carbide and DuPont, living in Chemical Valley, West Virginia, living in like a modern day colony, and having to recognize like that own ancestral trauma, not only of, you know, native people and mixed bloods that live within West Virginia, but also of like the unwanted migrants of Europe that weren't considered to be white people that were sent propaganda in Europe to go work in the coal mines and stuff like that. But, and like being in Guatemala and being with like the people that lived in the pueblos over there and seeing that their water was contaminated with banana pesticides and on, the people were like, wow, like this isn't an isolated thing. And I know hearing stories about like Flint and stuff was really frustrating because people were like, oh God, Flint, Michigan's water is so screwed up. And it's like, well, you know, if there was a water crisis, there are no borders. If it gets into the water, it's just going to go everywhere. Right. And when we were in camp, like we talked about Louisiana and the tail end of the pipeline. And I wish that honestly, I really wish it could have been more organized that after Ochetti and Chicongu and Black Hoop and the Sacred Stone camps had gotten raided, that people would have just all gone en masse to Louisiana. Like that would have been the best case scenario if that would have been the most strategic spot to be at, right? To continue the No DAPL struggle. But I think that Louisiana pipeline struggle means so much to me because it makes people have to recognize not only did the DAPL camps and our resistance there do this a ripple effect where people continue to move on to other struggles and continuing to fight other pipelines, but that the DAPL struggle almost three years later has never stopped, that we're still doing it. And that means a lot to me just because I know with the federal charges, having to deal with family doing time in prison and having to live with, you know, somebody who's on house arrest dealing with federal charges that were put under all these gag orders and stuff while we're dealing with the federal charges that we're not allowed legally to like openly talk about, like what our story is and all the struggles that we're going through is so incredibly isolating and traumatizing that you feel like, you know, we're the handful of people that are still fighting the pipeline on a daily basis. We're the ones that are still stuck here in North Dakota and having to worry about like feds coming into the house and searching through our stuff, or if our family is safe in jail and prison, and everybody else just seemed to like move on and go on to the next struggle, or they got to go home with their families or whatever. But the Louisiana camps are still fighting DAPL. And I think that was really, I know when I went to camp that I definitely had this expectation of like, I don't know if we're going to be here for 2 months. I don't know if we're going to be here for 20 years, you know, like it's just going to, this, if this really is going to be like a real deal resistance, it's going to be whatever it needs to be for however long it needs to be, you know, but definitely Standing Rock is not supposed to be this end all be all, right? That was like us humans as a species being like, it's not too late. It's just long overdue that we can stop the self-sabotage of what we've been doing to the planet. And, you know, to remember whose lands we're on and that they're still here, you know, and that people can be allies to Indigenous people. And I mean, I think I'm really glad that the Louisiana camps are doing what they can after 3 years of us still struggling with DAPL, you know.
I think some of the things that I've seen that Bridge Pipeline Resistance has carried forward from Standing Rock is one, like centering the leadership of Indigenous women and seeing how that they have then faced the greatest brunt of retaliation a lot of times, or like that's what I at least seen from afar. And then just one other thing that I would mention, I think Olive has spoken to and touched on, and Lorenzo from Unicorn Riot had said this at the premiere of their documentary, and it's always really stuck with me, is talking about in their documentary trying to capture the ways in which like we did something and the state did something, then we did something and the state would do something, and like that, and the state would learn from it and they would become more organized in their repression. And I'm not sure that Standing Rock and water protectors out of Standing Rock were always good at doing that, or we were good at doing that. And granted, you know, there's so many different elements and tactics and that they were able to employ that intentionally tried to stop us from doing those things. But what I've seen at least carry forward is the ways in which charges are much significantly worse now in terms of trying to incorporate frameworks or legal frameworks like critical infrastructure bills and things to that effect that jump simple charges like criminal trespass to felonies. At the end of camp, at the end of Big Oshodi-Sakowin, on February 22nd, 23rd, the legislator, there was a lot of like threats and rumors that if you were caught in camp or arrested in camp when the cops were going to raid camp, that you would be charged with a felony. And that didn't happen. Everyone was charged with misdemeanors and many people beat their charges out of that. But in Louisiana, many people were getting charged with felonies for just being on the property or even in public waterways because it somehow interacted with what's called critical infrastructure bills that have been newly introduced into different legislators and seeing it for the first time take effect in Louisiana from what we can see. Kind of taking note of that. The one other thing that I also was able, that I've seen and seems like a different strategy that's been employed with places like Louisiana and Minnesota and Wisconsin being explicitly in conversation with the police forces out of North Dakota, whether that was the National Guard or Morton County Sheriff's Department, is what North Minnesota and Wisconsin at least started doing is that they would take the bond if somebody had missed their court date. They would take the bond and that bond would go for restitution to Enbridge in Minnesota, where they're trying to build the Line 3 pipeline. And also to build on that, which I'm not sure a lot of people know, is that there was two water protectors who were found guilty in Wisconsin, I believe, related to the Line 3 pipeline fight. And when they were found guilty, they were charged with $18,000 and $45,000 worth of restitution. And it's not for damages, it's just for stop time. And that's something that they also did in North Dakota when 27 people were charged with felonies from that day, what's known as Railroad Day. Many people were charged for restitution, but it wasn't for any damages, it was just for lost time. And it's, you know, ways in which the government is not only like fathers through in private companies, you know, interest for just private profit, but it is specifically engaging with it and protecting it in the ways in which those employees are also sent then to different trials to make sure that water protectors or people resisting these pipelines are charged more heavily. And that actually reminds me of one last point that doesn't need to be included, but something that I was thinking about was what Olive was talking about when they shut down the bridge for construction or to fix it because of its structural integrity, what and then led to 1806 essentially being out of commission for 6 months. Mm-hmm. It was in Dion's sentencing when the judge had asked if there was any restitution that was needed from the fire, and the prosecution admitted that there was no restitution that they needed. Once they repainted the bridge, it was all back to normal.
Yep.
5 to 6 months to paint a bridge.
Yeah.
Awesome bureaucracy. So how do we support and respect those who put themselves on the line to fight these pipelines and that have been taken prisoner by the state?
I think it's, I would just like to emphasize that I think it's important for people to give the people that are taking the fall for all of us that did the same, we all did the same work every day within camp as those people did, that we're all just praying to like be at the right place at the right time to just do what needed to be done, and treating prayer as not as a sentiment, but to make it tangible, right? As like an act of willingness. And I think that, you know, people have to recognize that we literally haven't had the chance. We barely even had the chance to tell our stories of what was actually going on when we were in camp, while it was literally happening in front of us, like, let alone, you know, with people sitting in locked cells where all of their communications and movements are monitored 24/7, or family members and legal teams have gag orders put on them, mm-hmm. you know? And then when we were like within camp, all of the disinformation that literally all somebody would have to do was turn on a phone and do a live feed where they're only showing half of what's going on and put some like up narrative, like some commentary in the background. And there's like the new framing of whatever the context is going to be of what's going on, right? And it was pretty immediate, like having to deal with like disinformation campaigns all the time. You know, even looking at AIM was like decades ago, and we're still talking about it, and we're still trying to learn from it, and we're still trying to gain clarity on like what happened during the Wounded Knee occupation and stuff. That mm-hmm. there's still a lot to be learned from the DAPL struggle, and not everybody has been able to tell their stories about what happened and the lessons that we have unfortunately had to learn the hard way, being targeted by the federal government the way we have, especially for the ones that are doing time. And I really think, just as, you know, when your question of the term of respect, I think that that's like the ultimate respect to give, is that for the ones that have taken, there's a lot of sacrifices that remain within camp where, you know, a lot of us are dealing with PTSD, or we've got permanent physical injuries. People, it took years to deal with like just the state charges, let alone all the federal stuff that we're still going through. You know, there's civil suits and stuff that haven't happened yet, or like in the works of happening. There are a lot of people that haven't been able to tell their stories yet. And I think like people just have to remember that, you know, the movement isn't over, and that it's not only continuing within like the Louisiana camps, but it has moved on to being continued within prison, the belly of the beast, like the place where people need help the most. Like, and I have to remember that I think that's why, you know, Tunkashla has sent some of these people to prison, is because that's where people need the most help. That's where people need to have those seeds planted to tell them, like, you know, hey, I'm not going to die in prison. And, you know, you guys can even be doing good work in here, and still to remember your humanity and not just be recognized as like, you know, some like federal inmate number. And but anyway, I just think like that term of respect, of being, you know, remember that people are still struggling and that people are still making a sacrifice against DAPL, and they're doing it for the land and the water and the people, mm-hmm. and that there's still a lot more to be told. And that's why we need people to not forget, and for people to also be patient and to not be giving into, you know, these crazy, there's just so much like disinformation and misunderstandings. It's really damaging, you know, like our own people exacerbating misunderstandings. That's the kind of that breaks down movements, you know, when you can't find ways to talk things out and to like fight, you know, ignorance amongst our own people, you know?
Yeah, I think what Alice said like really sums it up really well. I think like one thing that like echo in that is like, or something that I think a lot about, especially in relation to the federal water protector political prisoners, is like to be humble. I think a lot of people sometimes like think that they got away with something out of Standing Rock, or thought that they did really radical cool for which they did or could have or whatever it may be, but the statute of limitations hasn't run out for a lot of people and a lot of the activity that went down at Standing Rock. There was a lot of cars that were set on fire that day. There's other charges that could still be in the wake. You know, I read a lot of discovery that suggests that it's not, you know,
right.
There could be way more defendants, and there still could be. I'm not saying that necessarily think there's going to be, but people should be, I think, humble in their approach, which I think just like echoes a lot of what Olive had already said about like security culture, and also in that same way of being respectful towards those who are like, who are bearing the burden and paying the price for people standing up and fighting for their sovereignty and to fight for their water and to fight for their rights. There are people, there are many people, there are many families now that are still bearing this brunt and didn't get to go home. They didn't have that option and continue to do that. And they continue to stand up and continue to do this work with integrity. Every federal defendant that is sentenced so far has taken a non-cooperating plea deal. And that's something that should be remembered and respected. I think that's like the primary thing that like that comes to mind, and you know, I would say I'm closest with Dion, and just as someone who's he's so young and had no record before this, and like showed up to camp, and I think in like the best way, and was even said to have done very little to nothing, and still is facing this amount of time. It's for, other people should know that it doesn't take a lot to be facing these charges when you're the target of the U.S. government.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's really important. Like it's devastating to hear people say, but I'm not doing anything wrong, or, but mm-hmm. I'm not talking about anything illegal, or, you know, they want me to be afraid. So they don't want me to talk. And it turns into not just like ignorance, but this ego thing of mm-hmm. people like to make this weird, I guess, like a persona for themselves. And I think like Standing Rock, unfortunately for a lot of people, there were a lot of like what we refer to as Facebook heroes and, you know, people instead of using like as an example, Rattler and Angry Bird, Little Feather, all of those names are comm names, which was like names that were only supposed to be used over the radios because we were purposely trying to like not identify people by their real names, right? Like as a security culture thing, but then it turned into like, but that's your Standing Rock persona. And now we're just going to use it as a nickname. And then, you know, people just like without discretion would throw out people's comm names as like their nicknames. And then it became mute at that point, you know, for us to be trying to protect ourselves with our comm names. It just became like nicknames and things like that. But, you know, I just remember this when we were talking about the COINTELPRO stuff yesterday. Mm-hmm. Snitch jacketing is still a really, really prominent methodology that the state will try to use against people. And they definitely, definitely tried to do that at Standing Rock. And it's unfortunately something that our own people will enable or perpetuate against, you know, other people that they're working with just because they don't know who they are, or it's unfortunate, but people will just call somebody an infiltrator if they don't f-ing like them. Like some people are just that petty, you know, that they'll stoop that low to be throwing slander and stuff like that at people. But it also just comes from like paranoia or misunderstanding about the legal process. Like I know with the state cases, I'm not going to name the specific name, but there was somebody that had legal papers that were outed that showed that they were listed as a state witness against other water protectors that had locked down to equipment. And everybody was immediately like, oh my God, this guy's a snitch. He's working for the state. Like he's no water protector, blah, blah, blah. And it was really unfortunate because for people that aren't ignorant about the legal process, we're going through like all of these different scenarios in our head, right? That it was like, well, he could be fighting a subpoena and these people just don't know he's actively fighting the subpoena. He could be fighting a subpoena and he may not even know that he had a subpoena put out against him. They could be putting him as a witness because they're trying to get access to his computer or because he had a camera that's got files on it. They could have gotten a coerced statement from him. He could have been interrogated and they could have been twisting something that he was saying, like whatever, we just didn't know. But people like jump to conclusions because the state like knows that if they put stuff like that on paper, people are gonna get paranoid. And it just kind of reminded me of like what the Black Panthers had to go through, where they were getting like, you know, feds were literally sending like fake letters and stuff addressed from mm-hmm. one Black Panther to another Black Panther. And then it's like causing all of this like internal, you know, divisions and stuff. Like this divide and conquer is very real. Mm-hmm. And that ancestral trauma mm-hmm. for Indigenous people specifically, that's like an important context to have with like federal charges and what happened within camp, like this divide and conquer that was going on is like all it's done is modernize itself. Mm-hmm. Even like Kyle Thompson, you know, Kyle Thompson was a mercenary for DAPL and he is Native. He's mixed blood. He's Lakota. And he was cranked out on meth, like taking guns into camp, mm-hmm. like almost shooting people. You know, they called him DAPL Apple because they referred to Indigenous people that like, if you're red on the outside, like you're Native, but you're white on the inside, you know? And I'm sure that caused a lot of like conflict within himself about his own identity and shit of like, you know, as a Native person, like I'm protecting the pipeline and, you know, as an armed mercenary against my own people, you know? And And then just the feds, like, I mean, they blatantly did that with Rattler, that they tried to snitch jacket him. And, you know, luckily, like, it didn't work. I mean, I guess, unfortunately, with some people, if they believe in, like, disinformation campaigns, it did work to an extent, but it didn't work in the way that the feds intended of, like, well, we're going to get this guy to flip, you know, we're going to plant seeds to get him angry at some other person or whatever. And then, like, he's not going to care about the integrity of the movement anymore. He's just going to flip on people. And, you know, for people that are, like, close to anybody who's gotten federal charges, it was blatantly clear to, like, everybody that it was like, if we can't get a non-cooperating plea deal, that we would rather go to prison for the rest of our lives before we would ever do anything intentionally to hurt another person. And I think that's also important to recognize, that it was really hard for people to accept plea deals, even though they were non-cooperating plea deals, because, like, we wanted the chance to go to trial. Like, we had such strong cases to talk about the human rights and violations, the environmental violations, the treaty violations that were going on, blatant laws that, you know, multiple states worth of cops and mercenaries had broken that day. The raid of treaty camp was blatantly illegal. And because we couldn't get a fair trial, because we literally gave statistics to the judge to prove that the jury pool already considered, before trial even happened, that most of the jury pool already considered them to be guilty, and we could not get a change of venue. I don't understand how stuff like that is legal and constitutional, that judges can just make decisions like that with impunity, that, like, well, we don't care if you're going to get a fair trial. Like, with Red Fawn, just as an example, went to court, and Red Fawn's attorneys were trying to present information about the informant, and that they were saying, like, we want to get information on what all this informant, what all intel that the informant gathered on Red Fawn, what he gathered on other people, if there were other informants that the federal government had sent in. And the judge just blatantly was like, I think that's going to overcomplicate the case. If you feel like you get convicted and that the trial was unfair, you can fight your conviction upon appeal. So that's literally the judge saying, you have a chance at a fair trial upon conviction. If you feel your trial was unfair, you have to appeal your conviction. I mean, at that point, and they wouldn't even accept Alford pleas. Alford pleas are the kind of pleas that you can give where you're saying, I'm not admitting guilt, but I'm acknowledging the fact that it's very likely I could get convicted upon the charges that are being given to me. And they wouldn't even accept Alford pleas. If they did accept Alford pleas, they said that everybody would have to plead guilty to the fire charges as well as the civil disorder charges. So at that point, it was literally like, so we're pleading for 15 to 20 years in prison. It's the equivalent of going to court and getting a guilty, and in North Dakota. So I think that there was a lot of guilt, you know, for people that, even though they were taking non-cooperating plea deals, and that they non-cooperating plea deals isn't going to hurt another person, but it was just the fact that, you know, they were acknowledging that they were never going to get. I just find it to be really frustrating, because I know that the feds gave the plea deals because it was like, they thought it was beneficial to both sides. Like, the feds don't want the information that we have that is yet to come out publicly. And I'm not going to talk about it too much because, you know, there are a few other people with federal charges that are still dealing with stuff. They're not done with their court stuff. So, but anyway, like, they knew the information that we had, that we had good cases, and they didn't want that information to come out. So they offered plea deals to save face, but they also were like, hey, you're not going to die in prison like we originally intended for you guys to do. You know, you're going to go to prison for like 3 to 5 years. So for them, it was like a fucked up win-win kind of thing, or like, beggars can't be choosers. Just take what you can get, you know? And I know, I mean, I still get letters from Rattler and Dion even, you know, where they talk about that Angry Bird, you know. I know Little Feather was really upset when non-cooperating plea deals were being talked about, because everybody knew that it's like, even when Angry Bird and Rattler were on house arrests and stuff, it was a really terrible way to live on a daily basis. Like, having to deal with like feds monitoring your house and not being able to freely like move around. And they just felt like it was like enough already, you know, like we could at least have our day in court. Like, they're rewriting this narrative saying that like camp was something that it wasn't, and that I did these things that I didn't do. And it was just really hard. It's just really traumatizing, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, for as much cynicism as one can come into this sort of scenario with, saying that, of course, like, the colonizers' legal system isn't going to provide justice when it's consistently historically stepped on treaty rights, it's stepped on you know, the recognition that someone is actually a human being. It's created different classes of subjects, you know, and different rules for different people. But yeah, I guess if you just go in with a totally cynical perspective, then there's not really any point of even facing the court, right?
Absolutely.
On that happy note.
No.
Thank you so much, both of you, for having this conversation and working this out. And this is going to be something I'm going to be really pleased to share this week. I think you both said some really awesome things, and I'm really happy that we could be a platform for getting these names into people's ears and hopefully getting them more attention. And I think there's a lot of lessons that you both have brought up in terms of movement health and individual approaches towards that movement and the continuation of the struggle that was you know, at the heart of the struggle at Standing Rock being a continuous struggle that is ongoing. So thank you so much for taking this time and for all that you do.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad we finally did this.
Yeah, me too.
And I do want you to know, like, all the, you know, our families and, you know, people doing time are really appreciative of people like you that take the time to talk to us and remember what they're going through.
Well, thank you. Please pass them my love.
Yeah, absolutely.
We will.
If you care to support the Final Straw Radio, please consider a one-time donation via our PayPal or a recurring donation via our Patreon or LibrePay. We have items on the Patreon and in our Big Cartel web store to thank supporters, including stickers, buttons, t-shirts, and zines. Great timing for the socially required gift-giving holiday season. We never charge for our audio work, so if you feel like you can kick something back cash-wise our way, we really appreciate it. Find out more at our website.
The Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle for another member.
Anarchism, a social philosophy which aims at the emancipation, economic, social, political, and spiritual of the human race.
Anarchism is not bombs, disorder, or chaos. It is not robbery or murder. It is not a war of each against all.
Anarchism is the very opposite of all that. Find out for yourself. Tune in to Subversion 1312.
Live, Tuesdays 9 to 10 p.m.
on 4ZZZ 102.1 FM or streaming 4ZZZ.org.au.
Podcasts and related content available at subversion1312.org
and channelzeronetwork.com.
Conclusion?
We stand for anarchy, anti-capitalism, anti-racism, anti-authoritarianism, internationalism,
autonomy, direct democracy, ecology, self-organization, solidarity, anti-fascism, anti-neoliberalism,
anti-nationalism, atheism, equality, and freedom.